This fall, fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
This ship collected five different life forms from the darkest corners of the universe. Monsters.
Collision imminent.
Invasive species. Predatory.
We don't lock them down, it will be too late.
Beware, spoiler phobes! You have stumbled into a storm of spoilers, a podcast currently covering the FX on Hulu series Alien Earth. This week, everyone is under observation. Hey! That's the name of the episode. Wendy can talk to the xenomorphs, Morrow and Slightly have a scheme going on that is targeting Joe for some face-hugging, and Nibs thinks she's pregnant. All this while Kirsch watches and doesn't tell anyone. This week's podcast is split into calm and storm sections. In the first calm section, we will only be talking about the newest episode of Alien Earth titled Observation, and then the previous half of the season for context. Then, after ample warning, we enter the storm section where Neil and I will speculate where the rest of this series goes and how it connects to the wider franchise. Why, hello, I'm Dave Gonzalez, and I'm a busker who snakes charms chestbursters.
And I'm Neil Miller, and you can't see it, but this week I am podcasting with my feet. And welcome back to a storm of spoilers. Before we get started, got a few housekeeping items for you. You are probably listening to this on Wednesday afternoon slash evening. That is when our new Alien Earth episodes come out. Stop back next Wednesday. We'll have another one for you. That's pretty straightforward. You can also, if you prefer the more visual medium of YouTube, get these episodes on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/@DaveAndNeil, DA70ANDNEIL. It's the how you spell it for literally everything we do. Those go up a little bit later in the week and feature our faces and our bespoke t-shirts that you can read.
This one's from my mom. Hey. My mom started watching the YouTube thing. She's like, well, if you need shirts, and
hell yeah,
she got me this Alien Earth shirt.
Shout out to Liz. Excellent choice. Normally, you would be able to also join me on Wednesday evenings on Twitch for streaming of Alien Isolation, a video game that we are going to talk about in the context of this episode. No stream this week. Got a couple of life things kind of getting in the way. But the good news, Dave, is that last week accomplished so much in the game that I am more than halfway through it. So
yeah.
We're not even going to be getting behind. So when we pick it up next week with the journey of Amanda Ripley in the Sevastopol station, we will continue running away from both illegally modified androids who are trying to kill us and a xenomorph that keeps trying to kill us and succeeded so many more times at killing me last week than it did in previous weeks. So that'll be on Twitch, twitch.tv/Neil Stradamus. Next week, if you'd like more from Dave and I, you can join us patreon.com/Dave and Neil, spelled the same way as our YouTube channel. For more content from this feed, all of our bonus content from our previous projects like Game of Thrones and Lost, Dave and I also did a really great Twin Peaks rewatch and a Leftovers rewatch. And we've got a great Slack where you can join all the coolest people on the internet and talk about all manner of topics. And you get a new adventure podcast every week. This week is the mailbag. It's going to be fun. We're going to be answering questions. And you can get our Hannibal rewatch pod, which we are currently in the middle of. We're closing in on the end of season one. We're actually going to come back to that here in just a moment. How can you get in touch with this show? How can you send us a raven? Stormofspoilers@gmail.com is the email address. It remains the email address. It has been that email address for going on more than a decade. I mean, definitely more than a decade at this point. So, you know, add us to your address book and email us whenever you want. You can also review us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. The rule, of course, leave us 5-star rating, say whatever you want, even if it's critical. People had nice things to say this week. Nobody had any negative feedback. Here is one from a user named So Many Aliens. They said, Dave and Neil are back and better than ever. So happy this feed is revived and serving excellent in-depth discussions of news and lore and trypophobic eyeball monsters. We've been talking about trypophobia quite a bit on multiple podcasts over the last couple of weeks. So thank you for the 5-star review. We greatly appreciate it. It's one of the ways it helps spread the word about this pod. I mentioned that I'm going to talk about the Hannibal podcast again, you know, you might ask yourself, how is this relevant? But that brings me to a little segment we called Mother Send a Raven, which is where we read some of your ravens. This first one is from Laura, who says, as I watched this week's episode of Alien Earth, this was actually for last week's episode, and Joe's lung was removed, I realized I only know what a lung looks like because of your Hannibal project. Pop culture images are merging together, like a lung pate from Hannibal's kitchen, like an alien tadpole wiggling into Joe's body part. As I write this, I'm so glad I've already eaten dinner. See you both at the Live Watch Sunday with probably no snacks. Thank you, Laura, for participating in both our Storm of Spoilers watch, Storm of Spoilers project, and hanging out with us for Hannibal. Yes, we've seen a lot of detached lungs in the last couple of weeks. Just,
yeah, it used to be like, I don't know how Colorado this makes me, but it used to be a fun thing when we were learning about like body parts in preschool. They would actually get like some cow lungs and they would use one of those reversible vacuum cleaners to like inflate it and deflate it in front of the class.
Oh, do cow lungs look like human lungs?
They look like enough like lungs. Okay. I don't know how I think I know what a human lung looks like from the Natural History Museum when I was young. And like they had a, you could take all the body parts out and then fit them back together.
Sure.
That was my first acknowledgement of a lung. But definitely now in my household, which I share with my girlfriend, I'm like, I'm going to use the TV. Got to watch a TV show for the podcast. She's like, every time you say that, it's something gross. And that's my life now this month with Alien Earth and Hannibal.
Listen, one of these months, definitely gross. We will get to something that is not in any way gross, I promise, but it's
not with October coming up, Neil. That's not going to happen.
Who knows? All right, moving on to a raven that is going to hopefully usher us into some calm discussion. This one from Phelan. Phelan getting in here once again, I think for like the third or fourth straight week, but another excellent email. Phelan says, Peter Pan's detached shadow in the story Peter Pan represented his rejection of maturity and adulthood responsibility. Adam Ines, Boy's right-hand man slash advisor, is his shadow. He's usually standing right behind Boy in a neutral monochromatic suit, sometimes in full silhouette, and seems to be the only boring adult counsel that Boy seriously considers. It makes me wonder if there's more to their relationship than just employee-employer. This is a great call out by Phelan, who last week correctly clocked that the xenomorph is the crocodile. And that is something that the episode absolutely said this week. This honestly answers one of the sort of questions that I was having, which is like, who is this Adam guy? Who is his Peter Pan analog? Especially because one of the Lost Boys is named Smee. And I was like, you can't, you know, isn't Smee supposed to not be a good guy? So there's that. And then Phelan tagged one more thing in his email that was a thought that I had, Dave. And I think this is maybe the best place to start. Which is, if the xenomorph uses the DNA of the host, something we've talked about multiple times, does that make the chestburster Wendy's brother too? And I think that's really interesting because we've discussed the fact that, especially when it comes to trying to pick apart like the different canon explanations for why xenomorphs look different in all of the different properties, other than the fact that they're made at different times with different levels of effects availability, it's that they sort of graft onto the DNA of their host. So This one that Wendy is talking to at the end of this episode also has the DNA of her brother, which is fascinating stuff.
I think it's like a half brother. I mean, it would be like a half brother if DNA was part of the deal.
Sure.
I don't know. We got a couple of other more discussions about the various Lost Boys this episode, and I am moving further away from thinking of them as human as of this episode. Mm. So I think technically, I guess this alien is her brother. I would be interested to see if she has, like, whether Wendy thinks of this as her sibling. Mm. She doesn't know necessarily about the lung, but she does seem kind of protective of it, like a pet or some such. I would be super interested if the show decided to go in that direction. I'm running in, because this is episode 4 of 8. Mm-hmm. We're running into the thing where I'm now worried that we're running out of time to answer all the questions that I would love answered. Mm-hmm. So now I need to kind of like pick the things that I want to answer and the relationships that I want to explore. I think one brother is going to be enough for Wendy this season. It will be interesting though, when this xenomorph grows, how she feels about it, because at least in all of the alien media we have seen, this week's episode is the first time that like all of our the main characters seem to be having a positive reaction to it. Boy Cavalier, definitely more of a capitalist reaction. But Wendy is like saving the scorpion like we saw in the first episode. Mm-hmm. So it's the first time we've had our sort of like female heroine kind of being on the alien side at this point. And I understand why she's on the alien side. I've just also seen too much xenomorph action to necessarily have it justified. I guess the closest we got was Alien Resurrection. I guess,
sure.
Neil, we watched Resurrection recently for a Resurrection month we were having. Do you think that version of Ripley, that clone Ripley 8, was ultimately on the alien side?
Well, yeah. And I do think that clone version of Ripley had an advantage that I don't think Wendy can have, right? And it is a DNA link, right? Mm-hmm. Because a cloned version of Ripley is still an organic version of Ripley. She wasn't a synthetic who had sort of a transferred version of Ripley's consciousness. She was an organic clone that was then sort of DNA
grown
linked.
Really fast.
Yes. Yeah. And then the xenomorph, or the what do we call it at the end of that resurrection? It's some sort of weird hybrid baby thing.
I think it's the newborn is what they call it in canon.
And so the newborn literally has her DNA in it. So there is more of a direct link there between the two. So I think that makes a little bit more sense as to why she's on their side. Then again, I think Wendy has all of the motivation she needs to be on the side of the aliens, right? She has now at least views herself as being chosen because they're speaking to her and only her. We don't necessarily know why yet, but, you know, this in her mind elevates her to being maybe a protector, or at least the vessel through which these things want to communicate. Now, we've seen enough of the franchise to know that they may not be speaking very clearly to her yet, but the message has always kind of been the same, which is you're going to die. Hello, you're going to die. That is what the aliens are saying. So we'll see if maybe these have a slightly different message, but I doubt it, right? Like the xenomorph has always sort of had the same modus operandi, which is, capture a new hosts, get a facehugger, put the facehugger on the new host, create more xenomorphs, take over. Perfect organism killing machine. That's it.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see if this show, this is where it wants to sort of bend the canon by giving these xenomorphs maybe a little bit more agency, or giving them sort of a more of a plan. And I think the wrinkle here is the other four entities that have been brought in, right? Like our little Mr. Octo guy being a highly intelligent. Because I've, you know, this is an interesting question about the xenomorph. I've always read it as very highly instinctual, right? It's right. It's a high level hunter. One would say maybe an apex predator, and it's at the top of the food chain in the sense that it has instinctual killing abilities that are far beyond that of any other entity we've ever encountered as humans, at least in this world. But I don't know if highly intelligent is something that I would attribute to the xenomorph. But if one of, but if our little eyeball guy got connected with a xenomorph, that creates a new hybrid that is far scarier, you know, something that might be able to communicate in a new way. So, you know, we'll kind of see where this show wants to, how far this show wants to push, not just the aliens being able to communicate with Wendy, but if they are able to communicate in a slightly more coherent manner, what do they have to say other than you're about to die?
Right. Or, yeah, if they're able to communicate in a more coherent manner, I think is really important, because I do think like everybody's in the show this episode sort of enthralled when she's able to recreate the alien sound. But as far as I can tell with her actual interactions with the chest burster, that's more like me doing a let's play pose for my dog or making vocalizations that a cat would recognize. Sure. Because I'm trying to sound like a cat. I don't think she knows what she's saying yet. And it'll be interesting to see if it develops to that point. Only because, like, maybe the fact that Wendy is so into these aliens means that eventually when, I believe, Boy Cavalier and Prodigy, or also likely Kirsch, continues to treat them as experiments, and she realizes that she is also an experiment that maybe creates a, you know, Wendy and the Lost Boys and the alien versus Prodigy. And I'm wondering if when Noah Hawley says that this, you know, series is ultimately about how technology and nature are both kind of out to kill us, if at like the end of the series, we're going to be looking at Wendy as a protagonist that we understand, but who ultimately is going to be on the side of the alien. Like maybe the audience's empathy is ready to be thrown to our legacy character, which at this point is the xenomorph. At the expense of these nefarious corporations slash Morrow, who's out doing his own thing. But I do briefly want to talk about it, because I did see in some analyzing of this episode the idea that what's going on between Morrow and Slightly is vaguely like grooming. And I will make I statements. Yeah, I'll make some I statements here, Neil. Definitely vaguely like grooming. Definitely, I think, because this series has done a really good job at keeping the sexual metaphor of the Alien franchise on the periphery, but adapting it in some more interesting, I think, less abrasive ways. This episode, the sort of like grooming nature of Morrow and Slightly, and then also what's happening with Nibs and sort of like the understanding of sexuality and being in an adult body when you don't have the hormones that allow you to make the actual pregnancy connections that would be in a human brain. So since we kind of got here through the alien, I'm going to jump to one of our corners, which is tracking the ability of Wendy and the Lost Boys, because we're already sort of there. Wendy could hear the aliens, can sort of like replicate the sound of an alien. But this appears to be something that only she can do, because Curly cannot hear it when Boy Cavalier asks, and at least as far as we can tell, nobody else can hear it. Why do you think at this point Wendy is the one?
Well, it's interesting because there is, within the context of the show, like a practical explanation, right, that they give us, which is that it's above a certain, right, it's above like 20,000 hertz
mm-hmm.
that this frequency comes in that she can hear. And what's curious about that is, like, you would assume that all of these hybrid bodies have the same specs, right? Same processor, right. Same amount of memory, right? So in theory, the other ones should be able to do it. So there is maybe something else that we're not seeing just yet that distinguishes Wendy.
Is it the same thing that allows her to control, like, computers? Because maybe. Boy Cavalier brings that up.
And again, I think we talked about this last week, where it's like, if Wendy, she even says this week that I'm older. And what she means is that she was in her body, in her new body, before the other kids. So maybe it's just a matter of her having more time to adjust and figure out what her hybrid body can do, right? The other ones haven't adjusted, or like in the case of Nibs, they are not adjusting well enough to be able to like focus, right? Like maybe Nibs in theory could get to that point where she could hear at that level, but she's literally losing her mind, so she can't do it. And you know, the other ones are sort of distracted or still too childlike to sort of figure it out. And Wendy is just, because she's been there the longest, she's honed her skills, I guess. But I'm still operating under the assumption that, like, physically their bodies all can do the same things. They just haven't figured it out yet. That said, there could also be an explanation, like her contact with the xenomorph in a room where we couldn't see her, right? The fight that she had with the xenomorph, something happened there, that in that contact something changed with Wendy, right? Mm-hmm. Similar to the way that Nibs is has been changed by the experience of being attacked by the little eyeball guy. So that is entirely possible, but I do think it has something to do with how long Wendy has been in her body versus the other kids.
This could be something that I guess I could end this season having a vague answer on,
mm-hmm.
because I do think this is the most likely place. And it was an idea planted by Boy Cavalier's assertion that, you know, magic is just really advanced science, which mm-hmm. we've heard asserted in pop culture a lot. You know, in my lifetime in the Thor movies, that was the big thing. The first Thor had to sort of lift was how can Asgard exist in the same universe as Iron Man. But it's this idea that, you know, at some point science gets so complex that it is basically magic. I'm okay keeping the magic there, only because I think if we delve really deep into it, I don't know if I want the question answered of if these hybrids have a soul or not. I don't know if that's an 8-episode answer that I want to get to. I think that's a mystery. I think that might even be one of the driving questions, especially about what their perception is, that could take us into an additional season.
Yeah.
If any of these people survive.
I think that this is a multi-season show. That's sort of a core question that's going to carry through multiple seasons. I would like an answer as to what separates Wendy from the other hybrids, though. And if it's just the fact that she was the first one, or if there is actually something different about her, or again, if coming into contact with the alien species changes them in some sort of significant way.
I also clocked, and it might be nothing, but I've watched enough TV to notice that we have not seen the inside of one of these hybrids mm-hmm. yet. Very specifically, when Dame Sylvia is talking to Nibs, she tries to show her a diagram.
We're so close.
I assumed it was a diagram that showed like she had no uterus or maybe no genitalia. Like, I thought that's where that scene was going. but instead Nib sidetracks it. And I'm like, what are these things? It is very possible that they are absorbing things from what they have contact with, like whatever sort of allowed them to copy over the brain patterns of a dying child is like a node that doesn't completely close, which would do something like you're talking about. Sure. Wendy fighting it. And then she fought it and came away, as I noted last week, basically as like the least amount of damage we've ever seen anybody come away fighting a xenomorph.
Yeah.
She just had that one little white drop. So I would like to see the inside of one of these lost boys, he said, as little creepily as possible.
And it's interesting, too. It's an interesting point, because if you think about the way that they are transferred, there's no plugs. This isn't the Matrix, right? We don't see them get plugged into the bodies, right? They're both laying on these tables, and they're just sort of like touching each other, and the table sort of lights up. And also, like, their bed slash charging station doesn't have like a direct plug. We don't see them plug in like we see Morrow plug into the ship, or like we see Kirsch plug into the ship. They have, they seem to have what are those, you know, wireless chargers? Like, I mean, an iPhone does. So they seem to be able to absorb things from, you know, without actually having like a hard connection.
Well, when Wendy is flipping through the various video feeds, like when her finger gets close to whatever screen it is, it has like a magnet effect. Like if you hold a magnet to a CRT. So they have some sort of wave barrier. They have some sort of broadcasting range where they could like touch and communicate.
But it's not like an Ethernet cable.
No, we haven't seen a port yet.
They like, have a little thing behind their ear, but that doesn't look, we don't know what that does yet. Each one of them has like a little thing behind their ear, but for all we know, that could just be a speaker or something.
Well, and then we saw, you know, Morrow being able to plant that device that was then sort of like absorbed into slightly. So I have a lot of questions about what these bodies are capable of. And what they're not. How do you take Nibs being pregnant? There are false pregnancy, real thing.
This is true.
Usually caused by a bunch of different factors. I think this one has to be entirely psychological, because we've said they have no hormones, so it's not a hormonal imbalance. It is probably a psychological response to trauma, which just seems like how they're talking about it in the show. So what do you make of this? And I guess if you could project a little bit into the future, I know this episode, Dame Sylvia says we have like a level 3 event. We don't know what that is. But where do you think we're going here? Why bring this Nibs plot in at this point in the series?
Well, I mean, I do think that it does a good job of establishing the threat of the hybrids toward the humans around them.
Yes.
And I think that, the easiest answer here is that it is a psychological thing, that she is having, a mental health issue, right? That is, she's not adjusting to her body properly, and she is having, mixing that with the trauma. Then again, we just talked about the potential of them being able to absorb things through their skin.
Yeah.
I did. For a second, as I was watching this episode a second time today, wonder, does she have something inside her after she touched that thing? And
we did mention in the preview or the first episode, I think, that every time we think about these new species, we should also think about how they reproduce.
Yes.
And we do think about Mr. Octo a lot this episode, but
yes,
how does he reproduce?
Yeah, well, and we see him take over the sheep, but I don't necessarily know if that's how he reproduces, right? Like, you know.
No, it seems to be just the same dude.
Yeah. So, if we think about it, just let's do a thought experiment this for a second. If Mr. Octo, when he touches something, can like implant eggs through like an osmosis like process, right? Through the skin, and he puts something inside Nibs, her body would not be able to understand what that is necessarily. And then she doesn't have necessarily the hormones to like regulate and control what's going on. Now she has this foreign substance potentially in her synthetic body that she doesn't understand. And she has a child's mind trying to interpret what's going on. And nobody's really running any scans on her because they're all busy working on Wendy. So you could see her interpreting that as, I got a baby inside me. I got something growing inside of me. Because that is, if you're a kid, that's like the most logical explanation for, I can feel something growing inside of me and I don't really know what else it could be. So I wouldn't rule it out just yet, right? Until we see, Dr. Arthur scan her and say, you know, she's clear. I don't necessarily know if we can rule that out, because especially now that we're getting more of Mr. Octo not only being a very obviously dangerous little guy, but highly intelligent. Like, I don't know, man. Obviously they keep flashing back to that moment to remind us of the terror that she went through. But they also keep reminding us that it was like grabbing onto her hands really hard, right? So there was a lot of contact there. So I wouldn't entirely be surprised. Now, I also have a lot of questions about what is a level 3 event. And it's clear that like Dame Sylvia and this facility were very prepared for this to go wrong. These hybrids, right?
She's got a
panic button, that's, you know,
I will say something is that the science, as Arthur points out in this episode, is going way too fast. Mm-hmm. They have like all this data they should be like collecting. But there is some evidence that at least at some point somebody built in some safeguards.
Yeah.
There's at least some confidence that the alien life forms are in a lab that will hopefully keep them. Nobody's been like, oh, I don't know if this like such and such going to work. They seem to have some safeguards. Just also whatever Boy Cavalier says goes, which like I had a conversation with some friends about things with alien Earth that sort of like wasn't working for them. And one of them was just like this idea that they would send these like billion-dollar prototypes into the recovery mission for the first two episodes. Mm-hmm. And at first I was like, oh, that's a good point. And then I remember it, like fucking Elon Musk was like, let me send a submarine to save those kids in a cave. And I was like, oh, never mind. That's exactly what like dumb billionaires who aren't thinking about things would do.
Yeah. And I think it's even, Boy Cavalier being a fictional trillionaire, he's an even smarter version of our real life idiot billionaires that we have. So like,
great.
You know, he's richer and more intelligent. So his confidence in the fact that he could probably just make more of these things if it goes wrong, I think is very high. And his narcissism is extreme, right? Like we see it again in this episode where he can't even let Kirsch have a moment with the alien, with the little eyeball alien. He's got to
point and
immediately establish with this, you know, extraterrestrial entity that he's the boss. I think that his arrogance, obviously, that's a core theme of this entire franchise, which is it's not just like rampant capitalism taking over, but this human arrogance in the face of the unknown and entities that are far stronger than we are.
Yeah.
is rearing its head once again. And you know, my favorite new thing is my new betting pool, which is like who or what is going to get to kill this dude. Boy Cavalier.
Boy Cavalier. I thought you were talking about Kirsch, but yes, no. Who's going to get to kill Boy Cavalier? Yeah. I
think it's very interesting. Kirsch is on the list.
Yeah, we're going to have to talk. We're going to add a Kirsch watch to the column this week because I think he's been around all the previous episodes. We haven't really focused on him. I think this would be a great episode to do it, but I want to get there first by saying one more thing about Nibs. I did clock that like Christianity survived longer than democracy did this week.
It's tough. Tough break for democracy.
I know, but like, I also like yelling at God. So the fact that it is the Christian God, like we're still yelling at the Father of Jesus, I'm sort of okay with that. I just did clock that with Nibs. And the second thing was, if this episode is, as I think, allegorical as it ultimately is, especially with some of the stuff with Boy Cavalier talking to Wendy and basically straight up talking like he is Peter Pan, I'm wondering if what Nibs is pregnant with is like an idea. I wonder if like it's that, and if that's going to manifest as something horrible. One of the strongest things that Prometheus did with body horror was Shaw's squid baby. And the idea of like a perverted pregnancy that is made out of like this ungodly abomination we've made by putting a child in a body that has capabilities that we don't actually know could be ridiculous. Or like you were saying, the idea that, you know, she's been infected with something and the only way her mind could process it is a pregnancy could be in reverse, where she thinks she's pregnant so much she allows something to become her baby, which is another way I think it could go.
Sure.
But I love how we're on the allegorical line. And right before we get off the this sort of creepy version of the hybrids, I think it's a good time to do our odds of hybridization consent, Neil. So we're tracking each episode of Alien Earth, how likely Neil and I would be to go for the hybrid procedure. This week, I have a little bit of a hesitation. We get to hear from Arthur, which is great. I definitely remember his name now because they gave him something to do, despite being Tame Sylvia's wife. But Arthur is like, best case scenario, we have AI running around thinking they're human. So according to Arthur, scientists who helped with this process, they did not transfer children into synth bodies. They trained an AI off of a dying child's brain. So with that idea, with the fact that the scientists behind it also don't think they have souls, and with all the talk this episode about them being units, I think I'm less likely this week than I was last week to want to become a hybrid. Because last week, I think it was attractive if I could maybe get in there knowing what I knew, but knowing that I would sort of be frozen as my teenage self, I don't think that makes me feel better about becoming a hybrid. So I'm getting less likely to give consent to become a hybrid this week. How about you, Neil?
Yeah, I mean, I do think this sort of takes a little bit of the shine off of it, the potential that it didn't work, especially because that really does create a question about the experience of the original, right? Like the original Marcy, is she in Wendy at all? Or is she just
dead, right?
Right. Because if what Arthur says is true, if this best case scenario is that they just trained the AI off of her, then Marcy's dead, right?
Yeah.
Marcy's consciousness is not in that body. And ultimately that means that this has failed and that they have not created a situation where they've defeated death, because Marcy died and this is just like a copy of her, a scan of her brain that is now thinking that it, like, it's a completely new entity that thinks it's her.
Right.
So like, that means that if I submitted to this, I would just be dead, which that's not what I was going for. Here, you know, so bummer.
I mean, it'd be nice to have maybe a computer Dave, but I don't think an AI based off me.
But
like, I could have an AI trained on me right now.
But this is, to me, different than like, that Black Mirror episode where they get downloaded into the computer and get to live forever. Google, Bothra and what's her name from the Terminator movie?
Yes, the Terminator from Terminator.
That's right.
Dark Fate.
Yes. So I think that's kind of a bummer. Then again, you know, they don't seem to be very sure just yet. In fact, that's one of the reasons why they seem to want to keep Joe around, is to try and figure out if they have succeeded, because it does seem like the viability of this product hinges on whether they've actually been able to transfer what we would conceptualize as the soul of the human.
Right.
Right. Because that, I guess, is what if we're thinking about it in practical terms, what a human soul is, which is like my conscious experience. can that be moved from my body to a different body?
I'm surprised they're so ready to make a product without, like, to me, as a consumer in this world who's interested in immortality, like, I kind of want to be able to continue growing and learning like a human. Mm-hmm. I would want some sort of guarantee that there was a soul. I want Joe's stamp of approval on this product.
Yeah, I would not pay for this unless I was 100% sure that I wasn't just going to, everything just wasn't going to go dark, right? You know, on that transfer table. So yeah, I think this makes me less likely to do it, but the jury is definitely still out, right? Even Arthur doesn't seem entirely sure of what they've done here. So we'll see. I think, you know, again, this is maybe one of the core questions that this show is going to have to answer, which is Wendy actually the same person as Marcy, or is she just a copy of a dead girl?
Yeah. Copy of a dead girl. That reminds me of several seasons of The X-Files.
Yeah.
Don't worry if you don't know what I'm talking about.
And in my case, I don't think that's fair, right? I don't think a copy of Neil getting to run around with immortality is as fun as me getting to run around with immortality.
You know, I
selfish as that may
that.
Sound.
I would appreciate copies for some reasons, but it would also involve them not having any sort of like actual independence. Mm-hmm. Like basically what I want is like animatronics. I would love the like you know, moments with Mr. Lincoln at Disneyland where it's just like dude stands up, gives a famous speech. It's a guy I never got to see in, you know, skin. That'd be fun. Look at that. But I don't want Mr. Lincoln to be like walking around and thinking he's pregnant. That's like a step too far for me.
Sure.
So yeah, if this is just an AI trained on what we think a child's brain is, that does not make me want to.
Because Mr. Lincoln would be freaking out and just become a serial killer who shoots actors because he's paranoid about actors killing him.
Yeah, well, at what point was Lincoln's brain downloaded into the into the Mr. Lincoln one? Yeah, does he have a historical understanding of who he is? What a world. Alien Earth, not just about aliens, as usually these kids sort of become more interesting. Let's jump there to what I think is a good segue, which is the Breton Parker Memorial character who most needs a union award. Neil, what are your thoughts on what happens with Joe this week?
I mean, listen, Joe wins this. I feel like Joe's going to win this award as long as he is alive on this show.
Yeah, then it just becomes the Joe Hermit Memorial character who needs
then it's his award. You know, we don't know how much a cyborg lung costs, but the look on his face says that it is a lot. Mm-hmm. And that it is, you know, and the fact that he is being told that he's going to have to work it off with a lifetime contract is bananas. But then again, this is the version of advanced capitalism that this society lives under now, right? Democracy is gone. Corporations rule. It's sadly not that far off from where we are now, which is psychotic to think about. I mean, they've got him right where they want him. And I think what's interesting is that we, the audience, get to see the fact that Boy Cavalier gives his shadow Adam the instructions that like they're going to keep him around before this conversation. So this dude goes in knowing it's a full manipulation of Joe. Like he knows that eventually whatever is going to come out of this conversation is going to end with Joe still being there. So he's just sort of pushing and pulling him around the room. And, you know, it's once again, just treating employees like playthings, and like property. And unfortunately for Joe, that ends with him basically signing over the rest of his life to this. That said, you know, we keep thinking about potential for, you know, maybe some sort of upheaval on this island that is very quickly barreling towards a Jurassic Park situation. And, you know, if the corporate structure is upset in some way, like if somebody offs this Boy Cavalier guy, maybe that'll help Joe get out of his contract. But I think that would require taking down the entire Prodigy Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we'll see. At this point, I don't even think a union would help Joe. I think they're going to have to burn the entire corporation down.
Seems very likely. Neil, did you ever see the 2010 movie Repo Men?
This is the with Jude Law and Forest Whitaker movie. Yes. I don't entirely remember the movie. It's a Darren Lynn Bousman movie, right? The director. This is the one.
Oh, it's a Miguel Sapochnik movie.
Oh, it's a Sapochnik movie.
Yeah.
Yes. This is the one where they are like they repossess body parts from people.
Yeah, so right? It's sort of like the Joe Hermit scheme, but basically we've the biomedical companies perfect artificial organs. Mm-hmm. And so you could basically live for much, much longer. Lung cancers, new lungs, etc. But sure. They're so expensive that for the rest of your life, you are making payments to try to pay off these organs. And essentially they're loans. And so the company owns the organ, even though they're inside of you. And if you stop paying, they send the repo men, who will just straight up take your organs. And whether or not you survive, because they'll just tase you and call an ambulance, depends on what organ you're having removed. But then they sort of like, you know, get Jude Law's character Remy into the thing by saving his life by like replacing his heart with the company thing. And then he suddenly just owes a whole bunch of money and gets trapped in the capitalism trap. That's where Joe Hermit is. He will never be able to pay off his lung. And so now Prodigy owns him even more than he was owned before.
Once again, the American style for-profit healthcare system is the real villain here.
So we also have a new fun thing with Joe and his lung is that I think, as far as I know, he is the only xenomorph host to survive the incubation process technically now.
I guess so. Yeah.
Because one came out of his lung, but he's very much alive.
In theory, assuming that he doesn't become a host the second time, which should also be a record, he would.
Well, I think that's real good.
He could become the first human to gestate a xenomorph in a part of his body and then meet the adult version of the xenomorph. That's fun.
That's what I'm interested in. How does a xenomorph tag its colony victims? We know how it tags its violence victims. It's just ready to kill things that are in its way.
Right.
But would they reimpregnate him, or would the DNA, would the xenomorph be like, that's me?
Yeah.
And not because it recognizes like a DNA tag. Is Joe safe from a very specific xenomorph right now?
Well, and I think this is a very fascinating question, especially because, you know, we get slightly at the end of this episode sort of targeting Joe, which is, many questions about Slightly's plot and how this is going to go down. Because I think it's going to work, but he's going to need some help. But yeah, it's like if he were to get Joe in front of an egg, would the egg even mess with Joe? A, because he's got a cyborg lung. He's only got one lung. Maybe it wouldn't even mess with him. And then B, would it somehow be able to tell that he is already part of the family, I guess?
Right.
And then, you know, we've already established that the big xenomorphs, the full size ones, can sense fear, essentially. Right. We see the scene with Morrow in the apartment building where, because he, I guess, either because he's not afraid or because he doesn't entirely have all of his human parts, one or the other, it doesn't kill him, but it kills everybody behind him. So will it be able to, again, because it shares DNA with Joe, will it be able to see, recognize that, and then either not attack, at the very least not attack him, but also maybe protect him? Like, that would be fascinating. Like, what if, hear me out, what if Joe and Wendy decide that they are no longer want to be part of this situation that Boy Cavalier has They don't want to be imprisoned by the Prodigy Corporation. They want to live with the Xenomorph. They want to live in the wild with their new friend, their new BFF, the alien. The alien may be protective of both of them because it sees Wendy, obviously. She's already charmed it with her song. And it literally shares DNA with Joe. So it's like that's a sibling to the Xenomorph. So I think that could be an interesting dynamic that I don't think, other than in like Resurrection, we kind of haven't seen the Xenomorph on the same team as a human or synthetic protagonist. So I think it's, this show is setting us up to maybe have multiple characters on the alien side. And we haven't even talked about Kirsch yet.
Yeah, we haven't even talked about Kirsch yet. Because we're still talking about who needs a union.
Yeah.
This episode also includes all the kids deciding maybe they want to advocate for themselves to have their family members present.
Sure.
If Joe's there, which seems like a bad idea to me, especially since I don't think they realize how much Prodigy thinks of them as property.
This is true. We definitely...
And, like, property doesn't get visitation rights.
We definitely don't. We also don't want their family members to be there because of all the aliens that are about to be running around this place. Very dangerous for humans.
Everybody who knows something they shouldn't about the Xenomorph in this time period in the story world is all on the island, which is not boding good for the island making it out of this season.
That said... If we're breaking it down into teams and one team is going rogue and one team has Wendy and Joe on it and the synth kids are also fairly safe from the Xenomorph in the sense that they have the ability to not have fear. We've been told multiple times they could purge fear from their bodies because they're not meat. And so if the Xenomorph teams up with Joe and Wendy, then the synth kids could also be on that team and ally themselves. They could create a union with the alien is what we're going for here. And then we're all going on strike. And by strike, I mean mass murder of the Prodigy Corporation, which is bad for Joe's former unit mates. But, you know, unfortunately, this is the Alien franchise. Some humans got to get got.
Yep. There is some precedent for humans and aliens working together. It's in a non-canon comic book, but we talked about in the preview episode, I think, or maybe just one of our various conversations about this franchise, about how I liked the... comic/novel Alien Labyrinth. And in that story, there is a scientist who ultimately finds himself in a hive and through some very disgusting methods does eventually learn to be part of the hive, even though he is a human and he is spared, even though he does have two good lungs. So there is a world where this works. It's just usually when we see the aliens have some sort of negotiation or some sort of communication. It has been about protecting the hive. You're the alien queen getting the soldiers to back off when Ripley points the flamethrower at the eggs. They have some sort of communication about protecting the hive. How they recognize their own.
Right.
We don't really know.
Protecting the hive, growing their, you know, replicating the species. Those are sort of the core goals of the Xenomorphs, but beyond that, they don't seem to have any more societal ambitions just yet. But, you know, this bringing them to Earth and having them interact with some other entities, some other highly intelligent alien entities that maybe didn't originate from their moon, creates some interesting situations.
And then we're going to jump to our Polygon Probe, where we break down some visual effects. I watched several times the Mr. Octo possesses a sheep sequence. I do think at the beginning, it's a real sheep. Mm-hmm. And I do think at the end, the staring is visual effects done over a real sheep. Mm-hmm. I also think the entire Mr. Octo gets attacks the sheep is 100% a CG sheep,
mm-hmm.
Which we're very well distracted by looking at something that we don't know what it looks like, which is the Mr. Octo monster. Right next to something that we do know what it looks like. We know what it looks like pretty well. And that also means that CGI is capable of basically giving it a body double. So I think it's a pretty good job. This is not digital smoke levels where it looks rushed. It's pretty seamless to me. There wasn't anything where I was like, that's obviously CG, except for the sheep's discarded eye, which does look a little CG, and I know why. It's an I like because in my when I it first fell, I was like, "That's a CG eye." Why? You can get sheep's eyes. We used to dissect them, I think, in elementary school to learn how an eye was made. So, like, you could get sheep's eyes. People slaughter sheep for lots of reasons. Throw away the eyes. You can get sheep's eyes if you want. But then I realized they had redesigned it to look more like Mr. Octo. So it has a little bit of the red flesh around it.
Mm-hmm.
And its nerves also sort of look like Mr. Octo's tentacles. So it's like, smart decision. I see why it happens. I have nothing bad to say about this week's polygons. Is there anything that knocked you about that sequence, or did it look good to you?
It looked good. Especially, and this is something that can get a little wonky, I guess, especially when you're doing a full CGI sequence like this, like when it goes into the full, fully digital part where the sheep is being attacked, is a digital blood splatter can get weird.
Oh, yeah.
But I thought the blood splatter moment where it slams its head up against the glass looks really cool. And almost to the point where I was like, that actually kind of looked a little real, a little more real than I expected. So this is really well done. And I think, you know, especially difficult, high degree of difficulty that you wouldn't expect, in the sense that it's like surrounded by reflective surfaces. That's not easy to do. Like, I know this is a very quick sequence, and maybe to the untrained eye, you would think, oh, this probably isn't that hard. But I would imagine this is the kind of sequence that would drive visual effects artists crazy for weeks, but they nailed it. So, you know, I didn't see any seams. It very seamlessly goes from real sheep to digital sheep, and then back to, I guess, sort of a real digital hybrid at the end there. And I love the part where he stands up on his hind legs. I think that looks pretty great.
That was terrifying.
I mean, I love the POV view from Mr. Octo. It's all so intensely scary.
Yeah, when the sheep stood up on its hind legs, I was like, did the Alien franchise just create its like most successful monster since the Queen? Like, this monster is scary.
Yeah.
It's not like semi-ridiculous like your newborn or your pred alien. It's just a scary thing that coexists with the alien species and is instantly smart. The smart thing is what makes it.
Yeah. Oh no,
it seems intelligent.
This is by far the most intimidating creature that they put into this franchise, for the simple reason that if this thing got out and got into a xenomorph, that is it. That's it for Earth.
Yeah.
That's it for the universe, man. Because xenomorphs, again, instinctual, perfect organism, does not have a high IQ, as far as we can tell. But if it had a high IQ, it's over. It's game over, man. Yeah. Like, that's it. So I think that I really love Mr. Octo for that simple reason. And the focus on him, right? We have five different species, and we've only really sort of gotten to know two of them. One that we already know pretty well, which is Xenomorph. But this Mr. Octo guy is
scary. Know as much as we're going to know about the Stephen Miller worm. So I would say three.
Oh yeah, I guess
I don't need more leech necessarily. But yeah,
I mean, we don't really know what happens after they fill up with blood. But
that's true. Mr. Adam does also point out to Boy Cavalier that like one of these Mr. Octos out there is sort of like game over for the world.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean,
so
you imagine how scary it would be if it got into a human or into one of the hybrids, right? If it was able to take over one of the hybrid bodies. But like, I'm sitting here thinking, like, if it got into a xenomorph, a full grown xenomorph, that's so scary.
Yeah. Interesting point about the hybrid body is if it is intelligent, it was going for Nibs, mm-hmm. which gives the suggestion that it doesn't care that that's a hybrid body. Or, mm-hmm. like we've been saying, we haven't seen the inside of one of these hybrid bodies. If they're a lot more organic, if they're a lot more replicant than synth, I would say, to mix some franchise. It took us 4 episodes to bring up Blade Runner, but we finally got here, Neil.
Well, and you know, I mean, we remember the inside of like Ash from the original Alien.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, it's not just like copper wiring in there. It's milky blood right. and some like gooey bubbles. There is some organic material, and that is a Weyland-Yutani creation. You know, one of the things that I've been reminded of when playing Alien Isolation, because you're playing on this space station and you're encountering androids made by the Siegson Corporation. And you're also learning this backstory about how Siegson was competing with Weyland-Yutani to try and create these androids, and how Weyland was like way advanced compared to what Siegson was doing. And it seems like Prodigy is even further advanced. These hybrids are even further advanced than what Weyland was doing. So if there were organic elements to Ash, who is kind of the current model of Weyland robot in this world, right? He's out there somewhere on the Nostromo, mm-hmm. or he's about to be out there on the Nostromo fairly soon. Then there could be significant organic elements to these hybrids. And that gives Mr. Octo an in.
Well, also, Mr. Octo, we've seen him attached to a cat. We've seen him attached to a sheep. These things have brains, mm-hmm. but I don't think they have like the same brains necessarily.
Definitely not the same size brains.
He's also doing like some sort of control with his limited amount of tentacles. You know, he's not like fully taking over the organ. He is interfacing with the organ somehow. So maybe it doesn't even need to be a fully human brain like you're talking mm-hmm. about. Maybe it just needs to have enough biology to take whatever input he's outputting to sort of make it come together. Before we get off visual effects, I do want to pose 2 things I don't know the answer to, but could be very possible. So I would love to see some behind the scenes footage in the future. One, that there was no glass in the majority of the scenes where Mr. Octo took over the sheep, that the glass was also a part of the computer effect.
That seems likely.
Because when you were talking about reflections, I'm like, unless it's a human, there's no reason to have a reflection in there anyway. You're already getting rid of the camera reflection if you have glass in there. So why not just make it full glass? The other thing would be what I think we got with the chest burster, which is a practical effect that is being modified by digital. So mm-hmm. when you were like, the splatter against the window looked really good, I'm like, it did look really good. Is it possible they just have a goat head that they're hitting against a piece of glass for like that one scene? Like, that would also be a great way to work around it. Save a little bit of money on your blood simulations. So I could also see that happening. I would love to see a breakdown after this as to how they put that scene together.
Yeah, and my assumption for the chest burster is that at least like the top half of it is puppeteered. Right. And maybe like
I would say like even the slithering looked like it could have been they could have done like rod puppeteering. But then again, the Alien franchise, Alien 3, sorry, has a poor history of using rod puppeteering successfully. So maybe it is just like a digital tail. Mm-hmm. But I do think at least, especially when she's like stroking it and clicking at it, like that's there.
Yeah.
Whatever's being augmented or erased is either a puppeteer or they're just making a tail go over whatever's the rod puppeteering it. Can't wait to see more of that happening. Also, I mean, we might have to wait a while, but the steps in between the chest burster to a full-size alien have always been very interesting. In that assembly cut of Alien 3, you get like the Bambi chest burster, which comes out but gets up in all fours, and we sort of see him steadily get up. Can't wait to see how this guy grows some legs. The hind legs, the difference between the chest burster and the final alien, the hind legs have always been a question to me. And because I think the series has never answered it, we always think about the Spaceball kick dancing version.
Yep.
That's the only face hugger or chest burster with legs I've ever thought about. So can't wait to see how that grows up. Let's keep thinking about that, but talk about the guy we've been talking around for four episodes. What is up with Timothy Oliphant's Kirsch, do you think?
All kinds
of
stuff.
Just in general. Yeah. Yeah. What do you think from somebody who's watched a lot of TV? He's seems to be as omnipresent as we are as the viewer, which I think is very, very interesting. So is he somebody that we're supposed to be relating to, or is he a villain in the wings?
I don't think he's a villain. I mean, I would like to start by saying, because it's a hobby horse of mine, Timothy Oliphant, just S-tier face actor, giving us full meal every time, facial expressions every time something happens in front of him. Absolutely magnificent. Every time he's on screen, I'm like, this is great. Keep giving me more of this. Because even though we know he is a full synthetic, right? He's a full android. He is giving us some of the most complexity as far as like emotional range. And I love that, right? Because like some of our humans are fairly one note psychopaths like Boy Cavalier. And then obviously we have these synthetics who are fairly one note literal children. So Kirsch is really interesting to me though, because the way the show is positioning his character is it's constantly reminding us that there is quite a lot of tension between him and Boy Cavalier, in the sense that Boy Cavalier is constantly punching down at him. In a way that seems very insecure, right? He's constantly like picking away at his intelligence and hitting at him for, you know, not being perfect in his execution of his job, and just you know, being that like shitty boss, right? To the point where I feel like Kirsch is like very high on my list of contenders for who's going to kill this dude. Because I feel like, you know, obviously the show wants us to think about which one of these aliens is going to get the big bad guy, Boy Cavalier. But I don't know, man, his android seems to also have plenty of reasons to take this dude out. But I also think that there is this interesting layer that they've added to Kirsch, because he's doing all of the experiments, because he's the only one that can get really close to all of the different aliens, that there's some sort of connection that he's developing with the different alien species, almost romanticizing, not in like a, you know, but like, if anybody's going to change teams, right, that's not one of the kids. Or Joe, I think it's possible that he does. And I find the plot line was slightly very interesting in this sense. Like as it's playing out, especially the scene where we're watching slightly go and sort of stalk Joe, but we're also seeing Kirsch go into the egg room and sort of pet one of the eggs. I'm like, is he going to help him? Is he going to help him infect someone as part of you know, the experiment, as part of extending the turning a blind eye metaphor that he was talking about earlier in the episode? You know, is he going to essentially, similar to the way, and we don't know why Morrow is like this just yet. I think we may find out soon. Yeah. But like, in a similar way to the way Morrow seemed to kind of be on the aliens team at the beginning, you know, when he was on the Maginot, is Kirsch going to have a similar situation where his proximity to these creatures is going to lead him to have some sort of empathy for them, or at least some sort of curiosity, scientific curiosity, that is going to lead him to be like, I might as well just help this kid infect one of these humans. Maybe not Joe, but like one of the other humans or something, because I kind of want to see what happens here. And maybe I think that humanity's had its time, right? Because if you think about it from his perspective, right, he works for Boy Cavalier. He was probably created by Boy Cavalier or his minions, his company. If this is the best humanity's got, right, this guy is the boy genius at the head of one of the most powerful five corporations in the world, and I'm an android who thinks that I'm standing in a place where we're about to move past humanity's organicness, right? You know, if these hybrids really are defeating death, then maybe humanity has had its time. And maybe I should just side with the aliens and get it over with. I feel like that's kind of the momentum that Kirsch's character is taking every time I see him on screen. And especially every time Boy Cavalier puts him down, I'm just like, man, you are playing with fire here. Because that dude's got the key to the most dangerous lab on the island. And if he just opens the door, you're all dead. All of you organic life forms are gone. Right? And, you know, what's more alien than the android making sure that all the humans get the worst of it, you know?
I agree. I'm wondering, since he's been asked to sort of like protect the kids and sort of been told by Dame and Arthur that, you know, they would like to make them more human. And he's like, why are we pretending they're human? I think these alien life forms show up and it's like finally something that is like actually interesting to me.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it's definitely gonna, I would classify him as a villain in waiting just by how androids go in this franchise. Plus the fact that he's basically designed to look like Rutger Hauer's character in Blade Runner. Sure.
He's a villain in waiting if you're rooting for the humans to survive. Maybe I'm not rooting for the humans to survive, except for like Joe.
Well, I mean, also, none of our humans necessarily have gotten a lot of sympathy from me at this point. Mm-hmm. So I'm still fine with it if we're just dealing with the humans. Joe, of course, being the exception, but maybe he's exempt through DNA. Let's see what we need to talk about before we head into the storm. We have our closing heart rock song this week is Ocean Size by Jane's Addiction. Not a song that I've been as connected to as our previous ones, but very interesting, especially when it's connected to the first image of the episode, which is sort of like the ocean lapping away this discarded doll's head.
Mm-hmm.
But my understanding of the song Ocean Sized is about an unhoused man who wished he was ocean sized so people wouldn't be able to fuck with him. He would just be too big to fuck with. Who do we think in this episode is kind of wishing they were too big to be fucked with?
Sure. Someone wishing they were so strong that the system itself could not push back against them. I don't know. I feel like that could apply to all of the characters we've sort of been focusing on, right? The kids, the hybrids, Joe Hermit, even to a certain extent, Kirsch, you know, basically all of the people who are caught in this prodigy prison.
Everybody but Boy Cavalier.
Yeah, I mean, everybody who has who does not have autonomy here. And I think that so far that's, literally everybody but Boy Cavalier. But, you know, I think there's a misnomer to that in the sense that, like, the hybrids have more autonomy than they know just yet, right? Like, they're stronger than they realize, at least most of them. I think Wendy probably has a pretty good idea or is gaining an idea. And I think Kirsch knows how strong they are. So we'll see.
And do you think when Nibs is, you know, being physically threatening, she's aware that she's being physically threatening? Because she might have an idea too.
She might be gaining an idea. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Although we don't know how strongly they're going to be able to lock her away in her room. We'll see how that works out. But yeah, it's
we don't get another scene with her after she gets locked away in her room.
It does seem to fit with this idea that these characters are realizing how trapped they are.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll be interesting to see what happens when they start looking for ways to escape this yeah. situation, not only the situation, but literally the island, and whether or not they turn to these new entities to try to help them. Right. You know, if it's kind of like Jurassic Park, but the kids let all the dinosaurs out because they want to get off the island.
I mean, that could be really fun. Some sort of conflict between Wendy and the Lost Boys, obviously, where it's about, you know, what sort of family do you adopt? If she adopts like a xenomorph and none of them get to see their family again, I could see that causing some trouble.
Sure.
But I think it is, you have a point here when Adam says to Joe, there's no universe in which you get to take her home. We've talked about how Peter Pan ends and mm-hmm. Wendy does get to go home. So there's a possibility that some of these people get out.
Well, yeah, and it's interesting because Wendy and some of the Lost Boys get to go home, but Captain Hook doesn't get to leave. The crocodile doesn't mm-hmm. get to leave. Peter Pan doesn't get to leave. So,
nope.
You know, that there are, if Boy Cavalier really wants to live in this metaphor and take it all the way down, that is spells some doom for him. So we'll see how seriously he wants to take that. I think that that is equally possible. And it's also possible that there's just sort of an upheaval and like Wendy takes over for him and she uses the xenomorph to that end, which I think would also be kind of interesting, especially if, again, if this show has ambitions beyond one season, which I hope so. It's a pretty good show. You know, I'm ready for another season of this show. You know, let's do it. I had one other thing that I wanted to hit in the calm.
Yeah.
Which is there is a reference that Mr. Shadowy Adam makes to a product that nobody wants, which was a blanket with sleeves, which is
yes.
For those who weren't around in the late 2000s, the first decade of this century.
Yeah. The turn of the first decade of the century.
Yes. You may not remember the Snuggie, but I remember the Snuggie. And I was like, wait, was that a product that nobody wanted? Because I remember that being a fairly popular thing. So I looked it up, Dave. Because I wanted mm-hmm. to see if that, because he's like, oh, this is a $1 trillion idea as opposed to a product nobody wants. Here's the thing, though. According to the internet, the Snuggie sold over 30 million units and generated more than $500 million in revenue between the years of 2008 when it launched and 2013. So in like, what is that, 5 years? It generated mm-hmm. $500 million in revenue and was, the young folks listening to us won't necessarily remember the as seen on TV craze because they yes. don't have cable now. But like this used to be a thing whereas like there were certain types of products that were like as seen on TV. This is one of the most successful as seen on TV products of all time. And, you know, the Snuggie was very significant. I never had one myself, but did I have one?
I definitely was given two by films that came out.
Yeah, I might have gotten one was like swag.
There was like a Cozy Reese Witherspoon something that I went to the junket for. They gave me a Snuggie. And then there was like a Netflix Snuggie they get because that was like the Netflix and chill period too. Mm-hmm. And so they're like, well, what else is that besides a Snuggie? Here's the thing. I agree that nobody needed the Snuggie. I appreciate all the things the Snuggie brought to our society. The as seen on TV craze, I think that's a fun thing to have happen.
Yeah.
There was a period of time where we thought maybe the ShamWow was better than a Shammy.
Yeah,
we were wrong, but that's what we thought.
Well, remember the Slap Chop?
Yeah. and then two, there is like a world where the Snuggie made it like easier to wear leisure clothing in certain places mm-hmm. Because I definitely ended up with my Snuggie at my desk at Teen Mom where I would be like a little chilly, time to put on the Snuggie. I think it was a step forward in the like leisure wear being okay for different situations. Maybe we took it that far. Maybe you shouldn't bring a Snuggie on a plane, but I think also maybe you should be able to bring a Snuggie on a plane if you have a blanket on a plane. Yeah. It is just a blanket with sleeves.
Yeah. So But this is something I would like to call in-world bullshit on, that this was not a product that no one wanted. So many people wanted this thing.
Well, will we remember it in hundreds of years? I guess Alien Earth is saying no.
If Ice Age 4 is still popular with kids, I feel like they're going to still remember the Snuggie somehow.
If they still know who Mr. October is, why this Snuggie slander? Good points. If you do not want to speculate about what's happening next week and beyond on Alien Earth, plus how it might be connected to other points in the franchise, now is your time to hop off. We will see you next Wednesday. We'll be talking about next week's episode. Otherwise, let's stick around for the storm.
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
I am the storm, brother. The first storm and the last.
And we're back for the storm. Neil, next week is the one we've been talking about since the beginning. Mm-hmm. It's the flashback episode to Noah Hawley's Alien movie. He is directing this one himself because in interviews he's like, if you're going to do this sort of thing, which is basically a twist on the Alien movie, why would I not want to direct it? It was one of my, you know, inspirations as a film. This will be fun to try to do. So, what did you notice from the episode 5 teaser?
I mean, I'm first of all just very excited that we get to stop and do a whole Alien movie right here in the middle of the season.
Right in between Xenomorphs, we get to go back.
Yep. Back into the aesthetic world of basically the Nostromo. The Maginot looks very much like the Nostromo. It's almost a one-to-one copy. There are several shots in here that I'm like, that's straight out of the original, and that's great. So I'm very excited to see how well Noah Hawley as a director can do at building tension and suspense and giving us some of that classic feeling of the Xenomorph stalking people. And then, you know, what he adds to it, right? Like, there's a suggestion in here about that I think we get a dialogue from Morrow about, like, somebody's doing sabotage. And, mm-hmm. you know, there's some complexity and some layers to what's going on with this crew. And I think that's very ambitious to suggest, right? Because they have to do it all in 1 hour long episode, right? They've got to flesh out who all of these crew members are, give us the full dynamic. And I actually think that they've set it up in a really good way, because they did a pretty good job in that first episode with very limited amount of time, giving us a pretty good idea of, like, kind of how this crew felt about each other, right? In just right. Like one scene. So I have confidence that they'll be able to pull it off. It'll be interesting to see how it all plays out. And yeah, I'm ready. I'm just ready for the atmosphere and the vibes.
Yeah, it is, I think, going to be interesting to see how they, if they do sort of like build out that much, or if we're there to answer a very specific question about the rest of the series, mm-hmm. Which is sort of what we speculated last week in the storm, is like, what makes you stop here and then go backwards?
Sure.
And so I'm looking to learn more about Morrow, but I'm also looking to learn, I guess, a little bit more about Alien lore, or maybe we're just looking for a saboteur. What I can tell is that it says 17 days from Earth. So we are picking up basically after that opening scene that we saw in Alien Earth episode 1,
right?
Where they all got around the table. And then we do see a facehugger in the beginning of the teaser crawling out of an egg that seems to be open to the world. The egg is exposed to the world. It's not in its case. So someone's opened the case that seems like a little bit sabotagey. Mm-hmm. We also see an exterior explosion that could be a little bit sabotagey. And then we mentioned last week how we know, very famously, these ships have an auto-destruct sequence. So that appears to have not happened. Instead, they decide to crash into Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to figure out all those things. But in terms of where our alien comes from, there is a shot of a facehugger grabbing one of the dudes. And I went back and I watched that scene from the first episode. He's not named. He's sitting there. He's wearing a green, like, collared shirt. Looks like some sort of engineer. And he is smoking a cigarette.
Cool.
Which made me think, John Hurt in the first Alien, smoking a cigarette. We need a person who is human in our lab to have slightly smuggle out. And we did see our misting gentleman smoking a cigarette.
Mm.
Is smoking a cigarette the orange, eating an orange in a mafia movie of the Alien franchise?
I mean, maybe. I guess the next question is, like, is there something about cigarette lungs that make you more attractive to a facehugger? Like, is the carcinogens or, like, the nicotine that stays in your lungs after you've smoked for, you know, maybe your whole life? Is that a more fertile ground for creating a xenomorph, right? Now that we know that they gestate in the lungs, or I guess we knew this the whole time. So that'll be really interesting. I mean, the other thing, Dave, is we see in this teaser the xenomorph in multiple parts of its life cycle, and we get a little shot of Mr. Octo.
Mm-hmm.
But we know that those are not the only two that were out on the ship.
Right. Yes.
And so far, we're four episodes in, we've seen some of the other creatures, but we have not seen them do anything, right? The floral guy, mm-hmm. we saw it, like, almost defend itself, but just sort of...
Well, but it was out when we saw it almost defend itself. Yes. It wasn't in the zoo lab. It was on the ship somewhere.
It was out on the ship. So we did not see how it got out. We didn't see how it got into that hallway. Same thing with... I mean, I guess we saw the leech guys do their thing. So,
right.
But we didn't see necessarily how they got out.
Well, it implies that all of them were let out. That yes. Just like everything's going to get
There's
out.
There's a fifth one that we haven't even seen yet. Right. We've only heard it and sort of, I guess, seen it kind of knocking against its cage. So I think,
which implies it was also there. It's still in its cage. Maybe. I am interested to see how they square that circle.
Yeah. So I am curious to see if this is the point at which the show gives us more information about all five species, you know, or at least the other four that aren't the xenomorph. So hopefully they have enough time to do that and give us, you know, the backstory. Then again, I mean, most, like, the backstory seems fairly simple, right? You have the saboteur, you know, maybe it's the distrust amongst the crew. We have a saboteur that's going to do some sabotage. And then you get, like, a couple of scenes with Morrow interacting with Mother, and we get the whole company perspective in that scene. Like, there's not, the Alien movies are not super plot heavy, you know?
Yeah.
So a lot of it is running around in corridors, trying to not die. So I think there's ample opportunity for us to get some time with these other creatures.
Back to the Alien. How far have you gotten in Alien Isolation in your playthrough?
I mean, I'm about halfway through.
Have you gotten to, like, the flashback sequences where you play the crew that actually goes and gets the egg?
No. I haven't gotten to any of that. I've only played as Amanda Ripley so far.
Got it. All right. So slight spoilers here, but I do think we have to talk about it, because if we're going to deal with them getting the eggs from LV-426, like we suspect they do, mm-hmm. then we have to talk about the beacon on LV-426, which is what lures the Nostromo in.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever happens here in Alien Earth, which takes place chronologically 2 years before the first Alien, the Nostromo's going to be pulled out of hyperspace early to go investigate this beacon. The beacon will be the derelict ship that then they get the other alien on, John Hurt gets impregnated with.
Right.
And then that presumably is also what spurs them later on to sort of send the terraforming group to make Hadley's Hope for aliens. But there's been a lot of questions about if they like know where these eggs and stuff are because of this beacon. So the question is, I believe, in Alien Isolation, because it is a video game set between Alien and Aliens, when you flash back to this crew that gets down to the derelict and Briggs and Abe up to the Stavis Pool, I believe the station is, the that you're playing
Sevastopol.
On.
Yeah.
Sevastopol. They go down there and they disable the beacon as part of the game. So the beacon that brought them down in Alien disables the beacon. And then presumably it isn't until Burke and hears Ripley's testimony at the beginnings of Aliens that they realize that like the eggs might still be out there in LV-426 because they had lost track of the beacon and maybe lost the actual ship until they made the Hadley Hope people go out and search for it. So if that happened, thank you to the LV-426 subreddit. The timeline is sometime in the late 2110s, Weyland-Yutani sends an updated flight plan and mission to the Maginot, instructing them to survey all the moons of Kalpamos, that's the name of the planet that has these LV moons around it, and secure any biologicals they find. And then when the Maginot gets there, they discover the derelict on LV-426 and secure a number of eggs. That's the omelet. And then the derelict beacons is activated at this point, since it was not activated when the Prometheus arrived in orbit to go to LV-223.
Okay.
So if we discuss next episode how they got the eggs in the first place, they might have also set a beacon to be like, let's go back just in case.
Okay.
Which could be the way that this alien Earth leads to the rest of the alien franchise slightly more directly.
So it would ultimately then be the Maginot's fault for accidentally luring in the Nostromo.
Right.
Cool.
Because the Prometheus aliens wrote on cave walls pointing to LV-223. LV-227 was a beacon that was basically like, stay away.
Yeah.
But I guess the Maginot activates it. It's going to be interesting to see how that happens. Because it looks like they adapted some of the technology, because we saw earlier with the omelet on the Maginot, they have like the smokescreen engineer above the eggs, that sort of smokescreen technology or monitoring system. So maybe we'll get some backstory on that. Maybe we won't.
Sure.
How did they find the alien in the first place? Will we get a mention that they once got a transmission from a David way back when? Would love to hear who knows what over on the Maginot.
Yeah. Well, and I would assume, at least at this point, that they're not going to have enough time to like flashback and show us any of the Maginot going to LV-426 or, you know, that planet. It'll be more something that they say in the discussions on the Maginot.
Right. Like, I think it'll be that. And then also whatever we see discovered next week, we know that Kirsch also has some thing of. So it's like he starts just calling them a xenomorph this episode, but it's because he's read all the files. He read all the files before they were deleted. So whatever happens, there are two people now on Earth who know what happens on the Maginot, Morrow and Kirsch, in theory. So I would like to see what the difference in that knowledge is, because obviously Morrow lived through it and Kirsch just saw whatever after action report they got to have.
Yeah. And that would, I guess that would suggest then that these other creatures came from the other moons.
In theory.
I mean, Kalpamos, the planet, is a gas giant. So that's not like you wouldn't land on that.
Well, but if the engineers were jumping around these moons making black goo experiments, it's also possible these other monsters are black goo descendants after like however many
Yeah, and I guess
just non-xenomorph descendants.
And I guess we don't, because there's, according to the Xenopedia, the wiki, there's LV-426, LV-223, and then one unnamed moon. So, you know, like, I guess the question is, you know, if these creatures all existed sort of in this ecosystem surrounding Kalpamos, how did they not interact, right? Like, how did Mr. Octo never get himself inside a xenomorph?
Well, now you brought me to our weekly, what are the odds we see a Yautja? Is that unnamed moon the moon that Predator Badlands takes place on?
I mean, who knows? That could be fun.
Is that too small of a world? Is that too small of a story world if all these, like, big space monsters all came from one system?
I mean, either that or, I mean, there's other possibilities too, right? There could be other moons around this planet that we don't know of. Also, this is just one planet in the solar system. Yeah. Like, we don't know how big that...
The Maginot could have been diverted to get the eggs after it had already gotten, like, four other species, for all we
know. This is the fourth planet in this system. We don't know how many other planets are in the habitable zone of this binary star system.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting to see. I do think we're going to get a little bit of the derelict, only because I went back again and watched episode one, and they did talk about when they were discussing they were burning too much fuel, maybe we should eject the menagerie. The old man with the goggles did say that they lost a lot of people getting the menagerie, so they've already lost some people before. It'll be interesting to see if that's what happened. But then also in that episode, when they, or also in episode two, I think, when we finally get to the Maginot crash site, there was that guy that had something else in his esophagus that we haven't identified yet. So, sure.
Well, no, and there, there's the one that had something in their intestines.
Yeah, it's 17 days from Earth. I think we're going to spend a lot of time on those 17 days, but I also think we might get a little peek what happened. But who knows? I don't know anything.
17 days is enough time for a lot of exposition, at the very least.
I am very excited that Wendy is talking to xenomorphs, because if this thing that we were wildly speculating about in the calm is true, which is there's some sort of DNA recognition between Joe and, like, the new xenomorph, I just think we're getting closer to putting Wendy in a partially xenomorph body. We're just like, if it's all in the family at this point, wouldn't, like, her family's DNA plus her AI child brains put together, wouldn't that be a more perfect organism?
Sure.
I can't wait to see.
Or
what do you, yeah.
Maybe it's not Wendy. Maybe it's Joe. Maybe there's something.
Could be Joe. I mean,
first of all, I think it's very funny that the show keeps putting Joe in situations where he should be dead.
Right.
And he keeps not dying. That's very entertaining to me.
He's Mr. October.
He really is. So I wonder if, you know, especially now that he has this cybernetic lung, if this is a body horror story about him going through some sort of evolution, and that I think would probably require him to come into contact with more than just the xenomorph at this point. But we'll see.
Yeah. If he black goo Joe, does he turn into another xenomorph? Guess we'll have to find out.
And then Wendy's like, well, now I have two xenomorph brothers. And that would line up even closer to the Peter Pan story, because Wendy's got two brothers in that story.
Yeah, it'll be great. I love it. Neil, any other predictions that we need to talk about before we head off into the next episode?
I mean, I don't necessarily think so. I mean, the other note I have is that I really want Dame Sylvia's couch, but that's not even a storm note. That's just a me thing. I really just want to, like, have her whole office as, like, my living room at this point.
Yeah.
So
they are definitely like at a White Lotus. That's what I thought when they were having that conversation in the jungle area. I'm like, this is a nice place. If this was the only place I ever saw, I might also, like Joe, be like, the governments didn't work.
Yeah.
Because this is a pretty nice place.
Yeah. Well, and I think I feel very strongly about my prediction that Kirsch is going to, well, obviously not next week, but at some point he's going to help push Slightly along. right? We get very, the show seems very intentional in showing us that he is watching the conversations that Slightly is having with Morrow. He's aware of what's going on. He's not stopping it, right? He's not, he's also not necessarily looking the other way. I think that for one reason or another, he wants to help, either because he has scientific curiosity about what's going to happen with the xenomorphs, or he wants to team up with the aliens, right? And he thinks that humanity's time is over. Or if he is somehow loyal to the company, this would be the best way to lure in and catch Morrow, which is like, let him think that he's about to get what he wants, lure him to the island and get him. So yeah. I feel like this isn't something that's going to pay off until at least episode 6, but Kirsch is going to let Slightly do his thing and we'll see.
I feel like if we are rushing towards the finale after episode 5, I feel like Kirsch gives Boy Cavalier to Slightly.
Maybe. I mean, there are other human options, right? We got all these soldiers running around.
That one just crosses off so many, that ticks so many boxes for Kirsch, where it's like, I get to see the alien come out, I get rid of my asshole boss who already wants to get close to the eggs for some damn reason, learns why he doesn't. Like, I think Slightly is a little too nervous, because I think if he was like, hey, Boy Cavalier, come, Boy Cavalier would do it instantly.
Here's the other thing, Dave, though. Here's the craziest theory that I have so far, that I dare not even speak this into existence, but sometimes I'm right about this stuff. If that were to happen, what if that's the moment we find out that Boy Cavalier is a hybrid?
That would also be interesting.
I mean, the show did suggest that he's organic, right? He got close to the egg and the egg started to open up.
Yeah.
So like that suggests that he is a real human, but
we could also be a cyborg. Like
that he's not fully human, right? The Peter Pan thing is too on the nose.
I mean, if he's Peter Pan and Morrow's Captain Hook, I just want them to actually face each other. That's what I'm more moving towards. And how does that happen unless
and then I want the crocodile
Boy Cavalier is the one. Yeah, Boy Cavalier is the one who has the implant. Anyway, we'll see if any of that's right. I'm definitely looking forward to Noah Hawley's Alien next week for In Space, No One is the title of the episode, inferring to the tagline of the first movie. In space, no one could hear you scream. So I expect a lot of screams. I expect a lot of body horror and maybe not a focus on synthetics as much next week. But then we do have Mr. Meng or whatever his name was, who was acting like a creeper. So we'll have to find out next week on Alien Earth. Until then, I don't know. Be excellent to each other and don't own organs. That seems like a good thing. Just like don't own, especially somebody else's organs. Yeah. Don't own somebody else's organs.
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.